and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, the beautiful, beautiful, sweet, lovely game. I'm Kevin Day, and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran, what have you been up to?
Oh, nothing much, Kevin. The world's a fairly quiet place at present.
Yeah, I thought so. It keeps turning, doesn't it, despite bad things happening to some people. But anyway, luckily we've got a pod to distract our attention. Despite what some people think on Twitter, we are doing the pod. We are still doing the pod. Coming up in this episode, we'll hear from Richard Kenyon, who's the Director of Marketing, Communications and Community at Everton, and also has recent experience of winning a big match against local rivals. But yeah, that's just a coincidence, Kieran. Although I was very pleased to hear, I'll let the listeners know, I'm always late because there's no two clocks in my house that tell you at the same time, and I have to walk 10 yards down my garden path to the old garage. So I invariably interrupt Kieran and whatever guest is have already met. And I came in just as Kieran was moaning about about Monday night to the bemused Director of Marketing, Communications and Community at Everton going, yeah, it's terrible, Kieran. I'm really, really sorry for you. But yeah, then we had a discussion about how the point of football is to actually score more goals than the opposition rather than just to keep pointlessly passing the ball about in front of them. Is that the last time I'm going to mention it? Yes, it is. It's the last time I'm going to mention it, Kieran. Kieran, it's Newsday, and after almost exactly a year, we have some good news. I was going to mention it came on Monday night, then people would be confused about what good news I meant, but the Prime Minister gave good news potentially for football because we could have fans back for the last Premier League round of games and for the playoffs. Will that have any financial impact positively whatsoever?
Well, if you take a club such as Arsenal, they can generate, you know, £4.5 million from a normal home game, but it looks as if the government's decision is that crowd capacity is going to be limited to either 10,000 or a quarter of capacity, whichever is the lower. But it's a start, and you know, I've been to a match with 2,000 people, and it was just great to be back. So I think that's be a positive. The only reservation is because it is going to coincide with the last round of matches taking place in the Premier League, it's therefore going to give some clubs, arguably, a very small advantage. It looks as if the Premier League chairmen are going to have a vote as to whether or not they're going to take up the offer to have this. I mean, the alternative is that if it's going to be Monday, May the 17th, when the rules are relaxed, part of me says, well, why can't all the fixtures taking place that weekend, why can't they be shifted to Monday night? Because everybody would be absolutely loving that. Everybody gets the opportunity to at least be in the lottery in terms of getting a ticket for the last home match of the season. And then I spoke to somebody in broadcasting, and they said, "No, we won't allow that because we've paid for matches to take place on Saturday and Sunday." So, you know, as for you fans, you can go and forget yourselves.
Right. So, hang on. So, just explain that again. So, it doesn't look like there will be. So, the last round of Premier League games is going to be just before the cutoff point, is it?
The last round of games in the Premier League is the 25th of May.
Right.
The lockdown ends on Monday the 17th. So there was a case for saying, that weekend's games and shift them to the Monday.
Yeah.
But I don't think the broadcasters will allow that, both domestically and overseas.
Okay. Now, that point you made there about there might be a slight unfairness, I haven't even looked at the fixtures. Are there any potential games that could resolve issues at the top or bottom between two teams in the last game of the season?
I think Fulham are playing Newcastle. So that could be an absolute stormer.
Well, that would be interesting then, wouldn't it? If the away team decides that the home team suddenly get an advantage they haven't had all season. But let's not worry about the bad things, because let's just concentrate on the fact that for once we do seem to have a sensible, logical pathway out of this, and the fact that fans could be back in, and by the time the Euros are happening, we could have pretty full stadiums, which is something we've been longing to report for a long time, Kieran. So that's very good news. The Big Six, or the so-called, Guy always says we should say the so-called Big Six, Premier League clubs. So I suppose Leicester fans would say you should clarify which Big Six you're talking about. But the Big Six Premier League clubs are pushing for the right to sell matches direct to fans in overseas countries.
Yeah, okay. Let's rename them the Greedy Six, perhaps, because that's more in line with their somewhat Machiavellian ways.
Ooh, somebody's still in a bad mood for some reason, aren't they?
So the Premier League rights for 2022-25 are up for negotiation soon, and it would appear that there is pressure from some of the larger clubs, and I think you can bet your bottom dollar this is being pushed by Liverpool, Manchester United, to give them, or to give every club, to be fair, the opportunity to sell the overseas rights for up to 8 games of a season. And they would use their own TV channels, they could use their own apps, they can go directly to the fan in terms of this relationship. So clearly that will give a significant financial advantage to the likes of Manchester United and Liverpool and Chelsea. And everybody knows that these clubs are the most popular in the Premier League, and there's no denial of that. Mm. At present, that gives them, on average, a financial advantage over the remaining clubs of around about £350 million a year. And the argument put forward by Joel Glazer and John Henry is that, well, that financial advantage is not enough because there's a danger that upstarts, you know, we got Leicester and West Ham,
yeah,
who are presently in the top four, which clearly is unfair on those big clubs, you know, yeah, who should by right be qualifying for the Champions League, regardless of how they perform on the pitch. So by extending the financial advantage over the smaller clubs, it would mean that it would be more difficult for Leicester to keep hold of James Maddison because they wouldn't be able to afford him to pay the wages. It's the same with Palace and Zaha. It's the same with West Ham and Declan Rice and things of this nature. So if you give less money to the smaller clubs, that means that the bigger clubs will be able to effectively act as sort of glorified praying mantises and just pick up the talent more easily than they do at present.
And I'm guessing, Kieran, that if the so-called Big Six, let's call them the Greedy Six, why not? If the Greedy Six are given the right to sell matches direct to fans in overseas countries, the matches they choose will be the games against each other, won't they?
Well, apparently they have said, oh, no, we're not going to do that because we know that it will reduce the value of the overall Premier League package. But my view is if they get their own way, then they'll say, well, we've done it for 8 games overseas. Why can't we do it for 8 domestic games a season as well?
Mm.
And all of a sudden, if you are a fan, now you're paying money to Sky and to BT and to Amazon, and you're paying your TV license, and now you're having to pay the club, and you're trying to go to, you know, a few of the matches yourself. So it could certainly become more expensive for fans. It would certainly be more lucrative for these clubs. But surely the success of the Premier League as a product, you know, and we hate to use this word because we're romantic fans, but as a ridiculously successful product globally, has been on the back of it being competitive. If you take a look at what happens in Italy, Juve have won it for the last 7 years. Bayern have won the Bundesliga for the last 9 years. PSG have won the French league. What these owners want to do is that, from a financial point of view, they want to make that glass ceiling which already exists, they want to make it that much thicker to prevent the upstarts from challenging. And the irony is that had it not been for those upstarts, had it not been from the fact that Palace have gone to Old Trafford and won this season, we've gone to Anfield, Burnley have gone to Anfield and they've won. And therefore, people watch the football because they know it's not necessarily going to be a walkover.
Yeah, and we always praise the bizarrely socialist model of the NFL, but the NFL are not doing it for good old-fashioned socialist reasons. The NFL are doing what they do, distributing the wealth in the NFL, so it remains competitive. So it seems odd that American club owners won't look at the example of their own countries to see what you should be doing with the money to retain the competitive league. But obviously their desire to win the titles every year, to get into Europe every year, outweighs the model of a competitive football league.
Yes, yeah. And of course, there's the somewhat insidious toys out of pram. Well, if we don't get our way, we're going to start to push for an 18-club Premier League, or we're going to change voting rights because, you know, I've seen some very senior football people say, why should clubs like Palace and Brighton, who have been in the Premier League for, you know, sort of, you know, we've been here, what, 4 years, you've been here 8 or 9 years, why should they get the same number of votes as Liverpool or Manchester United? The idea of one person, one vote appears to be alien to these billionaires.
I mean, that win you had at Anfield was annoyingly amazing. Be honest with me, Kieran. Around about 10:05 on Monday, were you tempted to just put the highlights of that game from Anfield on just as a little palate cleanser? I said I wouldn't mention it, Kieran. That's not fair. I won't. That'll be the last time I mention it, except unfortunately there's a question about Roy Hodgson coming up, which producer guy seems to think is my birthday present. Which, thank you for that, Guy. I'll take it as Easter, Christmas and birthday from you. On a similar note, Kieran, the boss of BT Sport, and basically this is, it sounds like his roundabout way of saying is there's not nearly as much money coming your way as there would be. The boss of BT Sports says Europe's top football league should be braced for a period of deflation. They got to brace themselves for a period of deflation in the value of their TV rights. Presumably, Europe's top football leagues includes the Premier League, does it, Kieran?
It certainly does. So this is Simon Green from BT Sport, and he was talking at the Financial Times Business of Football conference. So again, I think it's indicative. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, the Financial Times wouldn't have even acknowledged the existence of football. Mm. Now it's got two dedicated reporters, and it even sponsors a football finance podcast on occasion.
So, amazing, yeah.
So, you know, the game has certainly moved on in that regard. If we actually take a look at the present TV deal from Sky and BT, they're paying 10% less than they had done in 2017-19. So that deflation has already started. Nobody noticed it when the latest set of TV deals went through, because the increase in the overseas rights more than compensated. But now I think there's going to be deflation all round. We've seen the Bundesliga rights, they've decreased by 5% for their next set of fixtures. I know that NDR Analytics, who are sort of a management consultancy firm, they've been looking at sport overall, and they reckon fees are down around about 15%. And the reason for this is that young people aren't particularly interested in watching 90 minutes of football as in the same way that our generation are. You know, they've grown up with Netflix and Amazon Prime. They've grown up with channel hopping and you know, OTT services and not watching live television. You know, they will binge watch and so on. So the likes of Sky and BT, if they are going to compete against Amazon Prime and Netflix, they've got to come up with products which aren't necessarily sport, to try to ensure that they don't have people cutting the cord in terms of what they offer their consumers.
Mm. Kieran, I honestly begged producer Guy not to include this question. I said, Guy, this it's insensitive. But producer Guy said our feelings were as nothing compared to our duty to inform listeners about football finance issues. And reluctantly, Kieran, I agreed with him. Basically, Roy, Kieran, you spoiled it now. You can't. I can keep a straight face on radio, but you've ruined it. You've made me. Roy Hodgson has told Crystal Palace to resolve the contract issues affecting 12 players in his squad before opening talks over his own deal, which even off the back of that 2-1 win the other night seems slightly optimistic of him. This is something that Palace fans have been talking about, well, not this week, obviously, but it's something Palace fans have been talking about for quite some time, that we've allowed a situation where 12, not just squad players, but 12 senior squad players, mainly first-team players, have their contracts up for renewal in the summer, which is baffling how that's been allowed to happen. But Roy Hodgson clearly thinks, you know, his contract is as nothing compared to resolving the future of 12 of these players, 8 of which I would argue are players we would want to keep.
Yeah, it does seem that it's an unusual approach taken by Palace. Mm. I would, however, say that it, in many respects, financially, it couldn't have come at a better time.
Oh,
because if we take a look at where we're going to be this summer, transfer fees in general, you've got players who you can either re-sign on a Bosman. And if so, you can offer them lower wages.
Mm.
Because if we take a look at what's happening in France and Italy and Spain and Germany and so on, in those markets, there's downward pressure on wages. If Palace want to get rid of some of these players who are out of contract, their replacements will be coming in on lower transfer fees because we've got deflation in the transfer market. So although I don't think it was clearly it wasn't planned. Nobody had any preconception of the pandemic arriving. If you were going to have 12 players out of contract this summer, it really is a perfect storm because you can get rid of the ones that you really don't want. The ones which you're a bit indifferent about, you can offer them a lower deal in terms of remuneration, and there's fewer places that they can go to as an alternative. And if you do want to bring in replacements, you can bring them in on less money. So it's a perfect buyer's market, and Palace are going to be big buyers this summer.
I wouldn't bet on that. I'm glad you said that it may or may not have been the plan. It wasn't the plan, Kieran. You saying it couldn't have come at a better time implies that there was a plan. As a Palace fan of long standing, I know that this wasn't a plan. Just as we happily went along with Roy Hodgson on Monday night, indicating that his plan was to be battered for 90 minutes and then score a goal right there. That wasn't the plan, technically, but we're happy for Roy. We're happy for Roy to take credit for that being the plan. Of course we are, but there's nothing planned about allowing 12 senior professionals to come up with, one of whom is somebody who scored that remarkable goal. Now, this story, I like this. That's the last time. I won't mention it again. I can't see any. Oh, I can see two occasions, but I'll try not to. And I say this, Kieran, childishly, because I know you're too big to do it to me if the roles are reversed next season. Plus, I'm hosting, so you haven't got half the chance. And I like this story. And with hindsight, I wonder why the supporters of Sheffield Wednesday didn't think of this before. You've always argued that football stadiums should have some kind of listed status as important buildings up and down the country do. And Sheffield Wednesday Supporters Trust have applied for Hillsborough to be classified as an asset of community value. What would that mean in practice if that application was allowed?
Well, if you are an asset of community value, you've got to prove, first of all, that the main use is for the further well-being of the local community. Mm-hmm. We will be talking to Richard Kenyon about the work that Everton have done. Sheffield Wednesday, again, a fantastic club in terms of the contribution they make to the local area.
Yeah.
Similar, you know, as you know, I work in the city of Liverpool. Mm. There's huge areas of social deprivation there. You know, there's issues of a similar nature taking place in Sheffield. So because they do make such a contribution to the local community, then we can effectively get some form of protection, but not a lot. I've got to be honest. And there are examples of other clubs who have gone through this route. So, but both Old Trafford and Anfield have been designated assets of community value. I think the key thing is in respect of transparency, and sadly, that is a word that is lacking when it comes to the way that Sheffield Wednesday have been run. We've not seen any accounts since 2018. The ground is now owned. Hillsborough is now owned by a company called Sheffield 3, which bought Hillsborough from Sheffield Wednesday Football Club for £60 million. But based on the last set of accounts, whilst they bought it, they haven't actually got round to paying for it. Now, you know, that may have changed since, but we don't know because they refuse to publish the accounts.
Mm.
So if there is going to be any plan to change the use of Hillsborough, then that would have to come out at an earlier stage. And therefore, that would allow the Supporters Trust at Sheffield Wednesday, it would allow them to get their act together to try to put up some form of case that would be inappropriate and things of this nature, or potentially, and I think this is unlikely in practice, to say, well, okay, if as we are sort of custodians of the asset of community value, we will try to buy it ourselves. So it's not a perfect barrier. It can't stop Hillsborough being sold for football purposes, but if there are any plans to change use, I think that is where the benefits take place. Now, I have seen some commentators say, well, this will therefore make it more difficult to sell the club. I'm not convinced of that, because provided you're selling the club to somebody with good intentions in terms of the long-term future and sustainability of Sheffield Wednesday as a football club, then the only possible use they'll want for Hillsborough is for it to host matches. If this goes ahead, I think it's a positive. We've argued before on the show that there should be ideally some form of ideally central, if not local, strategy in terms of preventing the potential use and misuse of football stadia. You don't want it to end up as a branch of Toys R Us, I can assure you.
No, and absolutely none of us would like that. This is not an area I have any knowledge of at all, Kieran, but it surely logic would dictate that only the owners can apply for it to be classified as an asset of community value, but that's not the case.
No, because it is a community asset, and I think the supporters trust are trying to get Sheffield Wednesday on board, because on board now, then it just makes, you know, it reduces the number of potential barriers. What you don't want is for this to go to some form of tribunal or have to go in front of the council or whoever's going to make the final decision, and, you know, the lawyers get involved, delays start to appear, and during that period of time things can take place. If somebody's a bit nimble, and that might not be in the best interest. So I think it's important that the club and the supporters trust are both rowing in the same direction on this. And I wish the Sheffield Wednesday supporters trust all the best, because, you know, they do have the best interests of the club at heart, because it's their club. Clubs never belong to billionaires. Yeah. They belong to the fans. They belong to the community.
Yeah, well, I'm encouraged by the fact that the club shouldn't necessarily look upon this as a hostile act, then. The supporters trust want the club to be involved. So that's good news. And how many times have we said this, Kieran, in the past year and a bit since we started it? You'd imagine the club owners would look kindly upon this, but we're too optimistic sometimes, aren't we? Not far down the road, Kieran, Doncaster Rovers chief executive Gavin Baldwin has expressed disappointment, shall we say, at the way the League One package was dished out.
Yes, I think this is an example of clubs now using communication in the right way. So Gavin Baldwin says, I'm the chief executive of the club. What I'm going to do is once a month, I'm going to write an epistle on the club website, looking at some of the issues which perhaps you weren't aware of. If they put the information out there and we choose to ignore it, that's one thing. Yeah. But I think he is doing the right approach, and we are seeing this from more and more clubs. And I think it's an example of best practice. That they're not the only club that are doing it. There's some fantastic examples, the likes of Lincoln and Shrewsbury and others that I've seen. So it's good that so many clubs are starting to realise that talking to fans who's grown-ups actually has benefits. But to look at the rescue package that has come from the Premier League to Leagues 1 and 2, every club in League 1 receives a flat fee of £375,000 plus a top-up based on average attendance. We've not seen the final figures for this, but the aim is to ensure that it covers lost gate receipts. So I think I think you've got to give the EFL some credit here, because it's a more sophisticated scheme than we've seen in the National League, where it's just flat fees. There's two flat fees per division, we've discussed ad nauseum the fact that the National League is now at civil war with itself. Gavin's then gone on to say, well, you know, we were aware of this, and we were aware that the bigger clubs, the likes of Sunderland, Portsmouth and Ipswich in League One, and clearly the likes of Bolton Wanderers in League Two, will therefore get more money. but I don't think he's saying that he realised they'd get quite as much more money. Right. And they are a six-figure sum down, you know, at least 100 grand down on what he says they were led to believe that they would be in receipt of. I think, you know, I've given credit to the EFL in terms of having a scheme which I think shows an appropriate degree of flexibility. Mm. Why this couldn't have been worked out almost instantly, because you know what the gate receipts are per club, and communicated to the individual clubs so that they don't get disappointed. It's frustrating. I've also just want to give a quick shout out to Doncaster fans themselves, because I read Gavin's chief executive report, and he said in terms of season ticket holders, and this is fans who love their club, they want their club to be in existence, less than 5% asked for a full refund in respect of their season tickets. And over half of them just said, just treat it as a donation to the club, because we're Donny fans. We want Rovers to be in existence. Mm. We want to be able to go and see them in 12 months' time. And we're in a position where we don't need the money. You know, clearly, personal circumstances must come first. Mm. But hats off to all those fans of Doncaster.
Well, and the fans of every other club who have done something
absolutely
similar. It's so frustrating, Kieran, that in League One and Two and in the National League, an attempt to help people financially has just caused so much division and rancor rather than the contentment it should have done. But it's a story that we'll be talking about until the end of the season. Now, given the circumstances of Coventry City, we mention them amazingly rarely on this show, but there is some confusion this week amongst Coventry fans over the future of the club's Ryton training ground.
Yes. For people not familiar with the ownership of Coventry City, it is owned by a hedge fund called Sisu. Sisu run Coventry City via a company called Otium Entertainment. And when you go through the crumb trail and find out eventually where Sisu are located, surprise, surprise, it's the Cayman Islands. Yeah, who'd have thought a hedge fund would operate from the Cayman Islands, that place which is, a place which is quite famous for its somewhat casual attitude towards corporate governance. So since Sisu acquired Coventry, the club has been losing money left, right, and centre. It's got accumulated losses. And here we're talking about a club that doesn't register. You don't think of Coventry as being ridiculous big spenders or anything of this nature. Kevin, Coventry City have lost over 85 million quid.
Since when?
In the past, decade or just over.
Wow.
They've got accumulated losses looking here at 85 million quid. And this is where I find Sisu's strategy very, very bewildering. Hmm. They've funded a lot of those losses. They've got outstanding loans to the football club of around about £40 million, which again goes completely against what you'd expect a fairly ruthless industry to be doing. So it's all very confusing. And then it turns out somebody who was eagle-eyed was looking at some documentation coming out for a local council, and Coventry's training ground, which is called Ryton, which Sisu bought via Otium Entertainment for 350 grand, now appears to be up for sale to be converted into housing stock. And if that is the case, it will be sold at a considerable profit. Ryton officially is on Greenbelt land, but looking at various pronouncements, I think that could be overseen, provided they can sort of prove that they'll find another Greenbelt elsewhere for some form of activity. So it is a bit messy. There's a very toxic relationship between the Coventry City fan base, who have had to go and traipse to Northampton, and now they're having to go to Birmingham, if they were able to traipse to a football ground, of course, and Sisu. And that's partly due to the fact that Sisu thought that they'd be able to get the Ricoh Arena, or whatever it chooses to call itself these days, they thought they'd be able to get it very cheaply when they acquired the club, and that didn't manifest. So now they've been kicked out by the landlords there.
Well done for saying eagle-eyed, by the way, Kieran. It just proves what a mature man you are, and I'm the lesser man for actually pointing it out. One more story before an interview, which I can only describe as one of the most positive and upbeat interviews that we've done for some time. FC United of Manchester have published their accounts for 2019-20.
Yes. And again, for people not familiar, I appreciate we've got lots of overseas listeners to the show. FC United of Manchester were set up as a protest by dedicated Manchester United fans when the Glazers had the leveraged buyout of the club that they love in 2005. It presently plays in the Northern Premier League. And the good news is after... They've had a few lean years. They had a bit of a problem, FC United Manchester, or Fukum, as they prefer to call themselves. They had a problem, internal strife at broad level. They didn't really have a proper business plan when they moved to their own ground, because they were playing at Gig Lane on occasion, where Bury used to play football. But they finally got their own ground called Broadhurst Park, and They things weren't as good as they should be. But the great news is that the revenue has held up almost for 2020, and that's in no way, shape, or form down to a fantastic approach taken by the fans. Again, you know, saying keep your season tickets, amazing raising of money for good causes. And as a result of that, they've actually made a significant profit. They made nearly 200 grand of profit in 2020, which is going towards the development in around the area of Broadhurst Park. And I've also got to give them a shout out because they are a club in the sixth, seventh tier of English football, but they are an amazing example of a community club, and they've been nominated by the Football Supporters Association for their food hub, which is, we'll be coming on to discussing things of this nature with Richard shortly, but is a fantastic example of delivering things to people who need it. And some of the other nominees, the likes of Clapton, who we've spoken to as well, hats are doffed firmly. If everybody could win that particular prize, I'd be only too happy for that community club activity prize to be awarded to everyone. And of course, other organisations have been nominated for other prizes by the Football Supporters Association, but voting has ceased.
Yes, and let's not hold our breath, Kieran. everyone's a winner, as far as I'm concerned. It seems, of course, like Everton are on the verge of exciting times, both on and off the pitch. So it felt like the right moment to chat to Richard Kenyon, who is the Director of Marketing, Communications and Community at Everton Football Club.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Are you still basking in the glory of that Derby win? Feels good, doesn't it?
It feels very good. It was a long time in coming. Obviously, everyone's talking about how long it is since we won at Anfield. I remember the last time we won, and I've been there many, many times in between, and usually come away pretty disappointed. So it was absolutely brilliant on Saturday night to get that result, to put that to bed, those years of not winning at Anfield. But also, it was a really, really good performance, I thought, by our players. I thought we thoroughly deserved it. And, you know, it was a good 3 points for us to get in the league as well after obviously two defeats during the week before. So puts us back on track and hopefully in contention for a European spot. So, yeah, very, very, very good to win at Anfield. And I haven't said that for a long time. Thoroughly enjoyed watching it. And it, as I say, great 3 points to get.
Yeah, I think people can tell already, Richard, if they didn't know before, that you not only do you work for the club, but you are an Evertonian through and through, aren't you?
I am, yeah, lifelong Evertonian. So I've seen some good days. I was a child growing up in the 80s, so was growing up through an absolutely brilliant period in our history. And, I mean, I used to go to games then and genuinely thought we were never going to lose. I remember being in tears as a sort of 10-year-old boy any time we lost, because it seemed that rare. Well, it was that rare. Love going to Goodison Park back then. Obviously still love going now in a professional capacity. But yeah, it's you know, brilliant club, always been my club and always will be for sure.
Oh, Kieran, imagine that, supporting a team that you'd think will never lose. What a wonderful feeling that. Talking of Goodison, Richard, there's been some more good news for Everton fans just a couple of hours ago, hasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. We've been looking to move from Goodison for a while now and started a few years ago to look in earnest at a new site for us down at the waterfront in Liverpool at Bramley Moor Dock. And over the last few years, we've been doing extensive consultation of our own fan base of people across the city region to talk to them about the potential of moving down there, to get their views, to get their feedback. And then in the last year or two, two or three years now, to get their support. So we've been out in the community, we've been doing roadshows, we've been engaging with lots of people, not just Everton fans, but also people who've of a different persuasion, people who don't support football at all, to try and inform them about our scheme. And as I say, to try and generate support for it. So we've been through that process. We did public consultation over two stages that saw more than 63,000 people come out and discuss our plans with us. And the vast, vast majority of them were very supportive of our scheme. And every question we asked them scored very, very highly, most of them in their 90-odd percent of approval. So we took that consultation into the planning process just over a year ago, and it was recommended for planning approval by the planning officer a week or so ago, and has had now planning approval for the stadium at the waterfront, but also for a legacy, community-led legacy at Goodison Park, granted by the local planning committee. So that's a really, really big milestone in our project. It now gets reviewed as a matter of course because of the size of the application by the government over the next few weeks. So still some milestones to go in the process, but absolutely delighted to get that approval from the local planning committee, and you know, hopefully a really significant day in the club's history. In years to come, we hopefully look back at this and think this was a, you know, really important milestone and a big step forward for us.
And there is even more good news on Monday evening, Richard. It's slightly overshadowed, of course, the Prime Minister's announcement by the game that followed it, but the fact that fans, it's just a shame you're away for the last game of the season, but the fact that it looks like fans will be coming in next season is fantastic, because Goodison Park needs to say goodbye with a full house every week, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And clearly it will be emotional in those years leading up to us leaving Goodison, because Goodison's been a tremendous home for us as a football club and has a great history. You know, it was in its day, you know, innovative stadium. Lots of things happened at Goodison Park first. It's held an FA Cup final. It's held a World Cup semi-final. It's got lots of things about it that are not just history for Everton, but history of the game. You know, very important stadium in world football, actually. So it will be emotional to lose, to move away for Evertonians, but also I think for people in the wider football world. But we do need to move. We need to move to fulfil our own ambitions, obviously, as a football club, and that's from a fan experience point of view, from a financial point of view, From a very simple point of view, that we've outgrown it. We've got a significant waiting list now, and we're sold out for every game. So, you know, the time has come for us to move. But also, it's very important to us in our city to move to a new stadium because of the regenerational impact that it will have. It will create 15,000 jobs in the construction phase. £1.3 billion worth of value it has to the economy. So lots of really compelling reasons for us to move. But of course, it will be a sad day when we leave Goodison. And talking of fans being back in stadia, we actually had fans back in December this year. And again, I've been going to games without, you know, behind closed doors with no fans there at all. And the difference just having a couple of thousand fans in there made was incredible. It felt much more like that authentic experience that we're all used to as match going fans. So yeah, hopefully if we can get some fans in before the end of the season, we probably won't at Goodison, as you say, because of our last game being away. But if the Premier League can start reintroducing fans before the end of the season or early into next, whenever that is, it's going to be, you know, a massive step and something that we're all looking forward to.
Yeah, I think all football fans will miss Goodison. It was the first all-covered stadium in the country and certainly the first stadium where small children threw toffees at Dockers on match day, which is always something that bemused everybody, I think.
The toffee lady, still going strong, and I'm sure we'll be taking that tradition with us as well.
Brilliant. Richard, just in terms of what you do for Everton, can you give us some context? Because you're Director of Marketing, Communications and Community, which is a fairly big remit. So presumably you've got a fairly big team to help you with that.
Yeah, I have two roles. I have the role that you just described at the club. And also I run our charity, Everton in the Community, which is the charitable arm of the football club. So my role at the club looks after the media and communication side of things, the marketing, which is selling the tickets and memberships and growing our profile globally. And also on the communication side of things, obviously a big part of my role and my team's remit over the last few years has been working on that new stadium consultation that I've just described. So that's been a really important part of our comms and engagement work over the last couple of years and something that, you know, we've been, we've done in a very sort of thorough way, but has been really, really enjoyable throughout the process. The other part of my role is as Chief Executive of Everton in the Community, and that is overseeing the charitable work of the football club or the charitable arm of the football club. And Everton in the Community is a large organisation. It's separate in technical terms from the football club. It's obviously a charity and set up that way with its own trustees. But obviously it lives because of the football club and you know does the great work that it does because of the football club and the engagement that the word Everton can bring into everything that we do. So. So I share my time between the two roles, and they've been obviously, like it has been for everyone in the last 12 months, been very, very different. You know, the marketing side of things and the ticketing has been about refunds and then partial reopening and managing all of that processes that we never thought we would have to do. Obviously, there's been different comms challenges, and again we've continued to press on with our new stadium plans, and doing some of that remotely has obviously had its challenges as well, but we've managed to stay on track. But the work of the charity has been really, really important through this pandemic era, because in any usual year we'd be supporting more than 10,000 people on our programs, and we've had to obviously continue to do that, albeit in a virtual way through most of the last 12 months. But we've also set up a campaign working with the football club that means that we can help people who perhaps we wouldn't usually be working with throughout the times of crisis. And that's had tens of thousands of people needing support, and us being able to step up as a charity and as a football club to help them has been really, really important. So it's been a very, very busy, dynamic year, but a year in which we've been able to help even more people in the end.
Well, I'm a trustee of the foundation at Palace for Life, so I know a lot about what you do at Everton. But you've just announced record annual revenue for the charity, which is astonishing. How were you able to do that in such difficult circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, we've been growing as a charity in the last few years, and obviously our plans were impacted by the pandemic, as you would expect. But we've had absolutely incredible support from a number of sources. Pretty much all of our funders, the organisations who make our programmes possible, have worked with us flexibly, and I include the Premier League in that, who've been absolutely brilliant. So we've been running our programmes in different ways, and everyone's been supportive and continue to fund our programmes in the main, even though we might be doing sessions over Zoom or our groups might be communicating by WhatsApp, the funding has been maintained. So that's been really, really good for us. We've also secured some new partnerships, which again has been really important in this year, but also will stand us in a really good stead moving forward. So we've already started working on our post-pandemic plans, whether that be around mental health, whether it be around supporting more people, young people in schools who are going to have very different challenges coming out of this. And we've also had absolutely tremendous support from our fans and following that, our owner and chairman. So I mentioned earlier about how part of my remit is looking after the refund process and managing all of that. When we announced that we were going to have to be refunding season tickets because we didn't see games coming back in the foreseeable, We started getting contact immediately from supporters right across the world, saying, you know, I bought tickets for this game, or I have a season ticket. I don't really want the money back. I'd much rather you used it to help local people, because this pandemic is obviously going to be putting some people in crisis. So we looked at that and we thought, well, okay, well, let's introduce that as an option within our refund process. So supporters had the opportunity to either take the full refund, make a partial donation, or carry it over into future purchases. And we were absolutely blown away. Just last season alone, we generated £400,000 from our supporters, which I just find absolutely incredible still. You know, for fans to say, you know, I don't want the money back, I'd rather help people who need it more than me, is just, you know, I think is amazing and says a lot about our supporter base, and also what they obviously think about our charity and the knowledge of our work that they must have. So that obviously helped us help more people. And then on hearing of that, the owner and chairman, our chairman, Bill Kenwright, and the owner, Mr. Mashiri, said that they would match it. So that gave us an additional 400,000. So we had £800,000 on top of some other support that we'd got to go out and help people who really needed it. And we've, the last count, the last data that I looked at, supported more than 28,000 families on top of the people that we would support in a normal year. And, you know, that has included buying hundreds and hundreds of laptops for kids who, you know, are trying to homeschool but don't have the resources to do so. So that's helping ensure that education gap doesn't get wider. We've actually purchased or delivered, through either us purchasing them or our partners helping us, and more than 250,000 meals now for families who need it. And we've also been paying electricity bills for people, putting not only the food on people's tables, but also plates and cutlery on people's tables who didn't have it. We've been delivering food parcels and then turning up a few days later and noticing that they haven't been used. And that's been because people couldn't pay their electricity to cook it or didn't have a microwave. So we've purchased that kind of equipment. We've purchased beds for kids who didn't have them. I could go on and on and on, but we've given a lot of support. But so much of that has been because of the trust that our partners have put in us and the generosity of our fans and our owner and chairman.
I want to bring Kieran in on this subject in a moment, but you also announced recently, as part of the plan to leave Goodison Park, that you will continue to invest in the area you leave behind long after you're in the new stadium, which I think is pretty impressive.
Yeah, the principle for that really was, when we moved from Goodison, in the sense of not playing football there anymore, we really just wanted to leave a legacy that would have value for years to come. And we thought about, you know, ways that value, shape that value could take. And our chief executive, Denise, basically came up with the principle that, you know, we want to generate as much societal value from that site rather than just selling it off for the biggest check that we could take, the biggest financial amount that we could take. So over the last few years, we've been working with different partners to look at what's possible for that site. And we're looking at basically extending our existing Goodison campus, which I'll come back to in a second. But it's really about putting whatever we can on that footprint that will help that area be regenerated, will provide better chances for local people, better chances for young people. So we're looking at education facilities, we're looking at health facilities. There'll be some retail, most likely. There'll certainly be some accommodation. But really, again, the principle guiding it is that it will deliver the maximum social value that we possibly can. And we've already started doing that. I mentioned just there about the term, the Goodison campus, and there are a number of buildings around the stadium that we've either taken over or built in recent years. So we have a number of buildings that are run as community centres. So we're running our youth zone from there. We're running programmes for the elderly within our community. We have our own school. We just had planning permission to build a purpose-built mental health facility on that campus as well, which will form part of our post-pandemic recovery plan. So there are lots of buildings in and around Goodison already that are forming a community campus. So what will appear on Goodison Park after we stop playing football there will really be an extension of that. There'll also be some open space and some green space. And one concept that we've got is retaining a little bit of parkland, if you like, in the middle of what will be the new Goodison campus to represent when we played football at Goodison. And we're talking about retaining the centre circle so that in years to come, people can still go down to that site and say that, you know, their kids are playing at Goodison, that kind of thing. So those plans are a little bit behind, obviously, as you would expect, the stadium, because it will follow the stadium build. So we've had an outline planning consent from the local authority for that, compared to the detailed consent from Liverpool City Council. So so really excited about what could happen at Goodison and the impact that could have on North Liverpool, which is an area that really does need investment and really needs to address some of the social challenges that exist there.
I love the idea of the Goodison footprint, as Middlesbrough did something similar. So you can still go and stand on the spot where North Korea scored their goal in the World Cup and where various Graham Souness tackles went in, which I think is brilliant. Kieran, I want to bring you in on the back of this because you and I are often accused of being hopelessly romantic about football. But Richard's just described to us a club, its fans and its community coming together as a positive good. And that's the sort of thing we've been arguing for ever since we started the pod, isn't it?
That's right. I think Everton, I've described Everton as having the best community scheme in the country. They've got a lot of experience. I work in the city of Liverpool and I've spoken to Richard, who is being incredibly modest as to the achievements of Everton in the community. The added value that it makes, every £1 invested by those community schemes in terms of the way it is able to turn around people's lives in terms of education, those people are about to drift off, mental health challenges and things of this nature is absolutely amazing. And it does go to show, at a time when too often, I think we get quite depressed on the show with the degree of cynicism shown by some people who seem to think of football as nothing more than a vehicle to make money, that actually the community spirit, which is enshrined in the fans, as Richard said, fans said, no, if we can survive without some of the money ourselves in terms of our season ticket, we want it to go to the local community. I think that's testament to a fantastic fan base and also the confidence that the fans have in Everton in the community itself.
Mm. Richard, before Everton, you worked closely with horse racing, which is my second favourite sport, and golf, which very much isn't my second favourite sport. But how different is working in football? Is it purely financial, the difference?
I worked worked on some of the sort of very high profile events in sports. I've done work, albeit as a consultant rather than in-house, for the Jockey Club and the Grand National, the Open Golf, and particularly the golf. is something that I really loved. And you know, the spectacle around those big events is quite similar to the sort of Premier League experience. Obviously, a lot of attention on them, a lot of scrutiny on them as well. So some parallels there, but probably the difference in being in football is the regularity of the events, if you like. I mean, stating the obvious, you know, we can have two home games in a week or three home games in a week even, whereas those big events that I worked on, you know, you had a longer time to sort of plan for them and prepare for them. I think the thing with football that I found is it's an industry with a lot of energy. It's pretty relentless when you're working in it, because, you know, there's always the next game. There's always the next thing to do. And for us at Everton, they've been big things in terms of, you know, the stadium is obviously a huge project for us. And delivering that alongside all the other things that happen at a football club is a big undertaking. So it's a lot of work. It's a very, very dynamic environment, as the other sports that I've been involved with have been as well. But I think the difference that I've found has just been that sort of, you know, that cycle that you're in. You're constantly looking at the next game. And also with that, you know, things can change very quickly. So from a comms and marketing point of view, we can have all the best plans in the world. But you have to change and you have to adapt to what that the broader sentiment is. So, you know, you can accelerate things when things are going well, obviously, and sometimes you just have to slow down a little bit to take into account how supporters are feeling or how the club is being viewed because of what's happening on the pitch. So, yeah, very, very, very dynamic industry, but one that I absolutely love being a part of. And I think the other thing on the charity side of thing and charity side of things, and really appreciate what you said there, Kieran, about Everton and the community, is that there's a similar spirit at the charity in terms of that sort of dynamism. My colleagues are absolutely brilliant at sort of taking things forward, and we have a very simple mantra, really, which is if we see a need in the community, then we act on it. And there are, sadly, within our community, lots of needs, lots of challenges. But my colleagues at Everton in the community are absolutely driven to try and address every single one of them. So from the very youngest in our community to the very oldest, whether it's physical health, whether it's mental health, whether it's homelessness, whether it's serious organised crime, we've got programmes tackling all of these things. And it's really because our team are just so obsessed, really, with just trying to make a positive difference. And as they do that, they just want to do it more and more and more. And they are absolutely brilliant. Everything that we achieve as a charity is down to the hard work, determination, and in many cases, bravery of my colleagues. And also the support from the very top. I mentioned Denise earlier. Denise used to be the chief executive of the charity. And I think that really helps us as well now that she's chief executive of the club, because, you know, we always get great support from the club and from the owner and chairman. I mean, the chairman established Everton in the community 33 years ago. So again, whenever we need to go to the club to ask for support, we know that it's an open door. So we're very lucky in that respect. But also just to add to what Kieran said, you know, lots of football clubs, most football clubs are doing brilliant work in their communities. And I think there's a lot more that we can all do to tell that story. And I think through the pandemic, a lot of the stories have actually come to the fore more than they might have done in the past. But there is brilliant work going on right across the leagues, not just in the Premier League. It's not just Everton in the community. By any means, we're quite a mature community programme, and we have a lot of diversity in what we provide. But most clubs are doing a really, really good job in the community, a very valuable job.
Yeah, do you know, Richard, I've got a lot of other questions for you, but I think that positive note is one we should probably end on as well. Just to say as well, we're looking ahead to the new ground. Kieran and I have visited Goodison Park as fans. I've visited there as a broadcaster, and it's always a trip I look forward to because Bill Kenwright, I can confirm, is a very generous host. Is that welcoming attitude something that you'll be able to look forward to extending when you're in a big super mega stadium?
Yeah, definitely. We want to retain all the best parts of Goodison, to be honest, and that has informed a lot of the design brief over the last few years. So we want the that sense of intimacy that's around the ground, you know, that the fans feeling like they're right on top of the action. That's a big part of Goodison. And, you know, our supporters say that, and so do fans of other clubs when they come. They, you know, we want it to feel exciting and you're in a cauldron, if you like, as a supporter. And, you know, you're right, despite the challenges of Goodison, you know, the lounges have been, a lot of them have been sort of fitted in. It wasn't sort of designed in. You know, we have, challenges around our broadcast facilities and the press box and press area and all that kind of thing, but just because of the age of the stadium and when it was built. But in spite of all of that, what we hear all the time is, you know, we have one of the warmest welcomes, whether you're coming from the media, whether you're coming into our hospitality, whether you're supporters from another club. You know, people like coming to Goodison Park. So we want the best things from that experience to be taken over into Bramley Moor Dock, but also for us to be able to benefit from all of the other things from a modern stadium that we just can't get at Goodison. So yeah, the warmth and the friendliness, sort of behind the scenes, but they also that sort of intimidating cauldron type atmosphere we want when the players run out as well. So they're some of the best things at Goodison, and we hope to take those with us for sure.
And of course, you'll be taking that legendary theme tune with you as well. It's not a theme tune, is it? It's an old folk song, but that's another thing that gets the hairs on the back of your neck raised, isn't it? When Everton players run out to that brilliant song.
Definitely, yeah. Zed Cars is definitely a big part of the club, and in the last couple of years, we've introduced a siren just before it as well, which I think is definitely here to stay now as well. So yeah, they'll be in at the new stadium for certain.
Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully, this Kieran and I will have got over our local differences by the time you move to the new ground, and we can come up and see you and have a drink in your new boardroom. But in the meantime, good luck with all your endeavours, and take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks very much.
I like the idea of the taxi driver test, Kieran, by the way, and I think it's nice. In a week where we did finally get some optimistic news for football, it's nice to have an interview that was so positive about the effects of football and about that particular football club as well. I thought a big tick by every question he answered, essentially. We know that Everton are a good club to visit, but he sells that club very well, and they deserve to be sold very well, don't they, by the sound of it.
Yeah, I mean, Richard is incredibly professional. He's totally dedicated. I've seen Richard give address students that I have taught, and they've all come away. Even the overseas fans who are Liverpool fans, you know, the overseas students who are Liverpool fans, say, "Well, I had no idea that Everton was doing so much," and it's something to be proud of for people in the city. But also, it is quite humbling that when you hear some of those stories, you know, people being given food parcels who can't afford to heat the cooker. What type of society is it? We're the fifth or sixth richest country in the world. How on earth is this happening? And as you know, I'm not party political, but something's not right, Kevin.
Well, neither of us are party political, Kieran, but I don't think it takes a genius for our listeners to work out where our politics really lie. And you're absolutely right. Something's not right when people can't afford food and they can't afford the electricity to heat that food on. And for everything that people like Marcus Rashford and Everton are doing, and Palace and Brighton and clubs up and down the country, they shouldn't have to be football clubs that are doing it. But you can only thank those football clubs for doing so. And I'm gonna miss Goodison Park, I have to say. I had one of the best broadcasting days of my life there with Sylvester Stallone. It's a wonderful stadium. But things do have to move on. And Kieran, as we move on, because this pod has been unexpectedly long, I'd like to, if you don't mind, Kieran, I'd like to say a couple of personal thank yous. First of all, Kieran, I'd like to thank you for taking it on the chin, this pod. Ali begged me not to say taking it on the chin. But I said, Ali, you know what his sense of humour is like. It will make him laugh. It will cheer him up. So, Kieran, thank you.
Not for the first time as well, Kevin, if truth be told, but that's to go back to the pink coconut days.
and thank you, obviously, to Christian Benteke and Jean-Philippe Mateta. What a way to mark your first goal for the club, a double nutmeg, back heel. Also, thank you to everyone who took part in our quiz on Sunday. Despite our best efforts, Kieran, I think it was fairly obvious that we had recorded Monday's show before the quiz actually happened on Sunday night. But thank you to everybody who joined in and made it such a fun occasion. A particular shout out goes to one of your mob, Kieran, Phil Shelley, who proudly turned his Zoom camera around to show me his collection of 295 Brighton shirts. Although I suspect 37 of them might have been Tesco carrier bags, but 295 Brighton shirts, I mean, that's a lot of shirts. I mean, that's as many touches as you had in our box in that whole game. But even more of a shout out to quiz participant Luke Owens, who from the 22nd of March is running 7 marathons in 7 days to raise money for the Charlie Waller Trust, which aims to educate young people and those with responsibility for them about mental health and well-being. So good luck with that, Luke. And if anybody of you want to donate money, and let's face it, 7 marathons in 7 days is a fantastic achievement. You can donate on his Just Giving page. Our next pod will be questions, as usual. So if you have any questions about football finance, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And I shall hand you over to the big man, the gracious man himself, Kieran Maguire, for the final thank you and goodbye.
Well, thank you, everybody. And thanks for all the kind words. The number of people that generally were caring about my welfare on Monday night. I mean, yeah, I've got members of my family who are, you know, as people know, I'm actually from South London, who have committed robberies. And I thought those were the biggest ones I'd ever seen growing up. But what happened on Sunday night surpassed that by Crystal Palace. So if you like the show, if you can give us a 5-star review, it makes a difference to producer guy. Kevin and I don't know why. And press that subscribe button and look after yourselves. And let's start to look forward to coming out of this goddamn lockdown. Yeah, we do have some light at the tunnel, and it'll be so great if we have some football and sport and music and theatre and comedy to look forward to in the forthcoming months.
All I can say, Kieran, that's a fantastically South London way, but my family have done actual robberies. There's not many countries in the world where somebody would use that as a way of illustrating their displeasure at a football result. That makes you proud to be British. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.